Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places. Welcome to Forward Thinking.
Hey there, and welcome to Forward Thinking, the podcast that looks at the future and says, revved up like a deuce, another runner in the night. I'm Jonathan Strickland.
I'm Joe McCormick, and our other host, Lauren Vogelbaum, is not with us today, but she will be back soon.
Yes, so Joe, have you heard of Moore's Law?
Moore's Law, we've talked about it on this very podcast so many times now.
So I guess that means you have, in fact, heard of it.
I've heard of it. I've talked about it. In fact, I know a lot of interesting things about it. Like, for example, the fact that it's not really a law, is it?
No, it's an observation. Gordon Moore made this observation in a paper that, and I'm paraphrasing here because I didn't write it down in my notes, but it had something to do with something like cramming more components on a silicon chip. It's something along those lines. But he was essentially observing that because of improvements in manufacturing processes and the fact that they were able to find uses for more powerful microprocessors, that we were seeing a doubling of the number of components on a chip every 2 years or so. It all depends upon the era that you look at Moore's Law. It can go from as little as 12 months to as long as 2 years.
I think it started as a year and has extended now, but the generalization often is like every 18 months or so,
yeah.
Some people might say. You should see, and the way this manifests practically, is a doubling in computer power.
Yes, computer processing power. So while it may not be a physical doubling of actual components on a microprocessor, the outcome now is that it's a doubling of the microprocessor's computing power. This is all about how, you know, throughout the entire history of what is known as Moore's Law, we have tweaked the definition to suit whatever the current state was.
That's true. We have extended the time period a little bit, but it is worth noting that this prediction has been remarkably consistent.
Yes.
And some people might say that it's sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy, that by stating this observation, it has helped us, not us like Jonathan and I, but much smarter people,
computer scientists,
much more educated and capable people, really keep this thing going.
Right. It's kind of a goal for people who work in the computers field to say, look, we want to keep this prediction true. We want to make sure that the devices that we're designing in 2 years' time are going to be twice as powerful as the ones we're designing today. Therefore, we've got this goal to shoot for, and it means making some pretty amazing leaps in engineering.
Of course, the sad thing about Moore's Law is that the honeymoon can't last forever.
Yeah, so Moore's Law is one of those things that has been predicted to be on death's door ever since the probably 1980s, maybe even earlier.
Yeah, and it hasn't been so far, but we know that at some point it has to.
At least if we're going to be building our computers based upon the same architecture that we've been using up till now.
Right, and so there are a lot of different things that you might sort of notice will end up working against Moore's Law. One of them, I think, is just sort of a funny observation that has been consistent for a while now. It's referred to as Page's Law. I think
right.
It was coined by Sergey Brin, right, of Google?
It may have been. I'm not familiar with the actual origin of it. I do know what the law is, however.
I think it was. Well, yeah. So what is the law, Jonathan?
The law is that as we get more powerful hardware, software will rise to meet the challenge to make that hardware just as slow as what we're used to.
Yeah, exactly. So it's like if every 18 months your computer hardware, a new computer will get twice as fast, every 18 months software gets twice as slow.
Right. The software becomes more complex, more bloated.
Yeah, it gets crammed with features you don't want
exactly.
That make it take longer to execute. And this may be one explanation for why it just seems like that computer that used to be so speedy is really sluggish now.
Or even just that the brand new computer you bought is as fast as the brand new computer you bought 2 years ago. It's just now it's running software that's 2 years further along as well. So everything has evened out. The playing field has not changed at all. In other words, if software manufacturers made a product and then never updated it, so it was the same, like let's say that there is a productivity suite that you like and it has never been updated. It's the same suite year after year after year. You can still get it, but it's no different than it was when it premiered. your computer would run that like it was nothing. It would be just lightning fast, but that's not the way the world works. In order to make money, these companies continue to upgrade their software, which means that you are now running a more complicated, bloated, you might say, software suite, and it runs just as quickly or slowly as your old one.
Features, Jonathan.
Yeah.
They're features.
Right.
They make it better.
Right. Because more is always better, right?
Yeah.
Like, so I definitely want to have that feature that no person ever in the history of mankind has ever actually used. But I want it to be there just because that way I have the option.
Yeah. So there is Page's Law, and that's been tracking Moore's Law for a while now, but there are also some physical limitations that Moore's Law might encounter.
Right.
So not just imposed by overambitious or greedy software developers, but by the laws of physics themselves.
Yeah. So one of those is called Dennard scaling or Dennard scaling, depending upon how you prefer to pronounce it.
Right. Well, technically we're talking about not Dennard scaling, but the end of Dennard scaling.
Right. So this scaling is all about the way these microprocessors receive power, right? And mm-hmm. and as long as the scaling holds true, then the amount of power we need to keep these microtransistors working, microprocessors rather, not transistors, working will be neck and neck so that the development will maintain so we continue to have optimal efficiency as far as we can based upon electronics.
Yeah, it should be obvious, but I guess worth saying the chip in your computer is an electronic device. It needs electrons flowing through it to work.
Yeah, so here's the issue. The problem is that once we got to having components of a certain size, remember the whole idea here is that we're miniaturizing components so that we can fit more of them into the same physical space.
Right. Your laptop doesn't get twice as fast by becoming twice as big.
Yeah.
It becomes twice as fast staying the same size.
Right. And that's because we have managed to find new architectures that either use the features that we have designed more effectively, or they have decreased the size of those individual components so that you can fit more of them onto the chip. This, by the way, is similar to the tick-tock approach with Intel. Intel calls their development tick-tock. The tick is when they end up creating brand new miniaturized components. The tock is when they have figured out the ideal architecture to lay out those components so that they are at their most efficient. Each ends up meaning that you get a boost in your computer's performance. The first is just because it's just got more power, more horsepower in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
The second is because you have optimized the layout so that you get the most out of that horsepower. Well, the problem with this Dennard scaling coming to an end is that once you get to transistors below 90 nanometers in size, which we're already there, you start getting electrical current leakage issues, which means that the efficiency overall of your system decreases.
Oh, okay.
So
that's saying like even if you could continue shrinking the chip,
yeah,
you might not be getting a return on that.
Exactly. And that would tie right back into Gordon Moore's observation. He had said that this was really an element of manufacturing and economics and less of some sort of innate, you know, law that guides computers becoming twice as powerful over a set amount of time. He was saying that it only holds true if the manufacturing processes and the economic returns make sense. If they no longer make sense, the law falls flat. So it may come a time where because the efficiency has dropped to such a point, it doesn't make sense for us to make electronic components any smaller, even if we are able to. So we might say, you know, engineering-wise, we can make a microchip that has even smaller components, but because of electrical leakage, it's not going to perform any better than the chips we already have. Therefore, it makes no sense to actually do that.
But Jonathan.
Yeah.
What about a crazy alternative?
I like that you did jazz hands. Is this like a musical? Like we have computers that sing?
I do them because the listeners cannot see them, and it brings me pleasure to have that secret.
Okay. Sorry. I just ignore that, listeners. Just pretend like I didn't say anything.
Okay. This crazy alternative is today's microchip architecture and our transistors are based on electronics.
Yes.
So you're using electrons, these
yes.
little particles that are part of an atom.
Mm-hmm.
That's the same way all our other electronics
They're
work.
They're so negative too, little jerks.
Oh. Your puns are strong. Okay. What if instead of using electronics,
yeah.
we turned our attention to photonics?
Oh, so you're talking about fundamental particles of light.
Right. So instead of messing around with electrons, you mess around with photons.
That is an interesting idea that a lot of people are very, very smart people are concentrating on right now.
Yes. I want to clarify this transition. It was not my idea. It is something we have read about.
Yes. This is something that we wanted to talk about because it's really an exciting proposition, especially for certain types of computing. It may turn out that there's never a practical way for this to become like the average computer's architecture.
On the other hand, it could very well become the future of computing.
It could. It could. It's really early to say right now. The field is still developing. We are still working on creating the fundamental building blocks that this sort of computer system would depend upon in order for it to work as we understand computers to work today. And here's part of the issue before we even get into all the details. Part of the problem is that we've really ridden that electronic computer train really far, right? We have advanced to such a point that in order to transition to a completely different computing platform, or at least a different architecture, we would need to have that architecture be advanced to the point where it could at least be a lateral move initially, and then to continue to develop in order for Moore's Law to remain at all relevant, or at least, you know, applicable in some way. So.
Oh, I see. So, like, it would be very frustrating if there were a 20-year gap in Moore's Law while we're waiting for photonic computers to catch up to electronic ones.
Right. We would essentially have plateaued with electronic computers. We would not be able to really get measurably faster. We might be able to do some tweaking here and there, and we'll talk about some, at least one alternative toward the end of this episode to photonics that could have us see some development continue using a tweak on traditional architecture. But it would mean that we would see a cease in the rapid escalation of microprocessor performance until photonics got fast enough so that it could take over and be the next new thing. It may be that both are working in parallel for a while. We don't know because photonics still are relatively young when it comes to optical computers. But we have been working in photonics for decades.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you have already interacted almost definitely with tons of photonic devices.
Sure.
One of the big ones I would like to bring up is just optical fiber.
Absolutely.
So,
it's really becoming like an industry standard.
Yeah. I come from Chattanooga, Tennessee,
mm-hmm.
where the electric power board, the local one, has optical fiber to the home.
Mm-hmm.
It's people love it there.
Yeah,
it's
super fast.
Super fast, awesome throughput. It is a good system. People are really happy with it.
Yeah. So optical fiber, this is kind of what has provided sort of a foundation for the photonics industry. The two big developments that happened in the 20th century that have made photonics an interesting area of study was the development of lasers and the development of optical fiber. So fiber optics are it's phenomenal in that you can really find creative ways to transmit data, multiple data streams across a single optical fiber simultaneously.
And if you think about just how optical fiber works, it's kind of amazing. I mean, talking about beaming these wave particle
pulses of light,
pulses of light, yeah. refracting through a tiny, essentially like a glass kind of cord
yep.
across miles and miles. It's really strange.
Yeah.
And
so you essentially covered the bases. It's the idea of you've got, I mean, if you want to be really, really simple, if you were to really boil this down to a very simple, idea, imagine that you and a friend are standing across from a football field and you have created a code. Let's even say it's just Morse code. You haven't created it. You're just relying on Morse code. You each have a flashlight, and you flash the light on and off in using the code as your basis, and you send messages to each other. Essentially, with a fiber optic cable, you have a very high-tech version of this, although it gets a lot more complex. So you have emitters and sensors on either end that mm-hmm. are converting these light messages back into electronic messages, or take an electronic message, convert it to light, send it across the optical fiber, where when it gets to its destination, it converts back into electric messages so mm-hmm. that a computer can understand it, right? So the neat thing is, not only does this travel at the speed of light across that optical fiber, not only do you not have to worry so much about interference with other types of signals, because photons are pretty good about not getting mixed up with that kind of thing. They're not into, being influenced by the wrong crowd. You don't have to worry about electromagnetic interference with photons.
Yeah.
The other cool thing is that you can use different polarities of light, because, light you can polarize in different ways, or you can even use different wavelengths of light, which we perceive as color,
right?
In the visible spectrum anyway. You can use different wavelengths of light, and then you can transmit multiple messages across the same optical fibers simultaneously, and they don't interfere with each other. Photons won't mess with other photons. So you could have, 10 different streams of data going across one single optical fiber. You could even have it going in both directions at once. It's bidirectional. So you could have this communication going on at super speeds. That's why you're able to get that huge data throughput. So the neat thing is that we've even seen cables for computers come out using this technology. Things, the original development name was LightPeak, and then Apple bought it and rebranded it as Thunderbolt. So the initial Thunderbolt cables, I believe, were all still copper. But the plan was to move to fiber optics using this technology, where you could do multi-threading through fiber optics and have really rapid data transfers, like 20 gigabytes in just a couple of seconds. It's crazy how fast we're talking. Now, what if, see, you still have a slow point. You still have a bottleneck at either end of that cable, right? Because mm-hmm. you still have to convert the electricity to light, and on the other end, convert that light back into electricity so that it can communicate with our devices, because our devices rely on electronic transistors. But if we could change that, if we could make the fundamental components of our devices communicate through light rather than through electricity, everything we had would have that kind of throughput.
It'd be kind of like having a universal currency instead of having to go to the exchanger.
Yeah, it would just mean that everything would be able to move at this incredible rate with these incredible options. But again, you'd have to figure out, all right, how do we achieve that? How do we build these fundamental blocks that we've depended upon? I mean, the development of the transistor dates back to the 1950s, and then we've seen the transistor improve over time since then. So we would essentially have to reinvent the transistor, and people, by the way, have done that, with photonics instead of with electricity.
Okay, so I'm trying to imagine the photonic computer of the future.
Yeah.
I'd assume you'd still base it on some kind of binary encoding of data, right?
Yeah, so, unless you were going to completely change computer science and information theory. Unless you were to go to a point where you say, all right, well, let's abandon Boolean logic. Let's abandon the basis for computers and create something entirely new. Then what the most logical approach is to say, how can we achieve a Boolean logic based computer system, but use photonic equipment rather than electronic equipment?
That sounds kind of fancy, but what that really, really boils down to is, inside your computer, everything is a matter of a long series of on and off switches.
Yes, those transistors.
Zeros and ones.
Those transistors are what we're essentially talking about as on off switches. They're gates that allow the flow of electrons in an electronic based system, but it would be photons in an optical based system. It would be a gate that would either allow photons to pass through or would prevent them in some way, in order for it to still represent that one or zero, that bit that is the basis of information theory in the modern computing age. So you would have to rebuild those basic components you find in computers, things like transistors, which if you arrange transistors in a proper way, you can create logic gates. This is like the AND, OR, NOR. If you ever study any basic logic, these are the basic functions that allow you to make statements and then evaluate those statements to get to the proper conclusions. That's the basis of computing today. That's exactly how computers work. So you would have to be able to make those logic gates using these photonic elements. And so right now, the state of the art as it stands today is all about trying to find new ways to create those fundamental components that will make up an optical computer and be useful. Like we've seen several developments that are really interesting, but they are mostly proof of concept, things that wouldn't be practical.
Let me guess. One of the big issues has got to be miniaturization. Shrinking it down.
That's exactly right. Yeah. Getting these components to be really, really tiny. I mean, you're talking about, like when you're talking about a microprocessor, just think about those tiny computer chips you've seen. And keep in mind that the components, the individual components on that chip are at 45 nanometers or even smaller, and a nanometer is a billionth of a meter. So you're talking about billions of components on a single microprocessor. Now you have to create something that can emit light and sense light and be able to to essentially do that without becoming an enormous machine. So in other words, a lot of the work that's done in labs, you might be able to create a system that is a good proof of concept, but if you made an entire computer that was of equivalent power to one of today's PCs using that technology, it would go back to the old days where your basic computer was the size of a building. So that would mean that it wouldn't be terribly practical on your next business trip.
So who's actually built like a photonic transistor so far?
Well, early work started in the 1980s. Uh-huh. So there have been a lot of people who have worked on it in various ways. But one of the more recent interesting stories was about some researchers at MIT back in July of 2013. They built an all optical transistor that could switch between 0 and 1 using a single photon. So we're not talking about a beam of light. We're not talking about a laser beam. We're talking about one photon. Remember that a photon represents a particle of light, but that light can act both as a particle and a wave, which means it has some quantum features.
That's a good way of putting it.
We're talking about stuff. When I say some quantum features, I essentially mean prepare to have your mind bent.
Yeah. The best way to understand this, if you're not familiar with this concept, is just to like go on the internet and look up the double slit experiment.
Right. Where, you know, that's certainly a mind bending experiment where, you know, things that, yeah, you would think it should behave a certain way and always behave that way, and it turns out that's not right. So in this particular implementation, what they had was a pair of mirrors, okay? And the mirrors could perform in two different ways. When it was in the on position, let's say that represents a one in bit language, a photon could pass straight through both mirrors, the pair of mirrors that are placed very closely together, extremely closely, as I'll mention in a second. When it's in the off position, only 20% of the light would actually pass through the mirrors. In other words, the photon would get bounced back. A single photon would not make it through. And here's the reason why this works. Light does behave both as a particle and a wave. Now, if it acted only as a particle, it wouldn't matter whether the switch was on or off. It would encounter that first mirror and bounce off. It'd be like, you know, you running at a wall. You're never not going to bounce off that wall unless the wall's made out of something really weak and you crash through Kool-Aid Man style. But let's say it's a cinder block solid wall. You would kind of splat/bounce off of it. It would not be pleasant.
However,
light also acts as a wave. And so if you were to look at a wavelength of light, the electromagnetic field of a single photon would overlap the two mirrors, because the mirrors are placed so that they are the same distance apart as a wavelength of whatever light you're using.
Okay.
So different types of light have different wavelengths.
Like different colors.
Yeah.
One color has a longer wavelength of light than another.
Yes. If you look at the Roy G. Biv spectrum, like a rainbow red to violet, when you're on the red side, those are the longer wavelengths. Mm-hmm. The further along you get in that spectrum, the shorter the wavelengths are. At any rate, you would have to have these two mirrors placed at the wavelength that corresponds to that particular type of light. If you did that, and you had this properly set up, when that switch is on, the electron would pass through as if nothing were there because the wavelength completely overlaps the distance of those two mirrors. So it acts on a quantum level like there's nothing there. There's no counterpart to this on the macro level. We can't have a version of Joe running at that cement wall where Joe passes through the wall as if nothing were there, because Joe only acts like a particle, not like a wave.
Okay, so as freaky as this is, it's not the only way to manipulate light for logic gates at this scale, right?
That's right, because you could do something. See, again, one of the big issues here is miniaturization, right? How do you miniaturize these mirrors and lasers so that you can manipulate light in this way? One other way you could take this approach is by developing something called metamaterials.
Metamaterials.
Yeah. So metamaterials are man-made. They're really, really awesome. Okay. So metamaterials are materials that interact with electromagnetic radiation in interesting ways, and it's all based on the physical structure of the material.
Right. So when we say they're synthetic, of course, we don't mean they're made of synthetic atoms. They're made of natural atoms, but they're...
Yeah, they can be made of anything, really.
Yeah.
I mean, some do certain jobs better than others, but what's really cool about metamaterials is the chemical composition doesn't matter so much as the physical structure of the material.
Right. It's how they're put together.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's the actual, like, if you were able to zoom in on a nano level of these materials, you would see certain repeated patterns. It would be kind of like, think of it like a scaffold, but it's a scaffold that extends out in three dimensions.
Mm-hmm.
So you would see these repeated patterns. Those repeated patterns would be what gives the metamaterials whatever particular function they happen to have. And they can have different ones depending upon the way you structure these things. In general, if you create a metamaterial that has a structure where the repeating patterns are smaller than the wavelength of whatever light you're using, that light can pass through the metamaterials as if it weren't there. This is also, by the way, the basis for a lot of cloaking technology, but that cloaking technology tends to be focused on microwaves because microwaves are even longer than visible light.
Yeah, the problem is getting the metamaterials small and densely packed enough to interact with things that have these tiny wavelengths.
Right. And if you wanted to have a cloaking device that managed to cloak against all visible light, that'd be really tricky because, again, visible light takes up a spectrum of wavelengths, right?
Yeah.
So you could, in theory, make a really effective cloaking device that cloaks you against a particular hue of red. So that would mean that red light would pass through, but other light would bounce back. So you would still see everything but red in whatever reflected back.
Right. Well, I don't know if we can predict exactly what it would look like. It would look very weird.
Right.
You would see a bizarre sight.
Well, all the red light would pass through it.
Yeah.
But the other light would behave just as light normally would on such an object.
Right. I'm just saying I don't know what that would end up looking like to your eyes.
I guess it all depends on what it looked like before you started messing with the metamaterials.
Right.
At any rate, there are some researchers who hope that they can use metamaterials in photonics, which would also lead to improvements in miniaturization, because you wouldn't have to worry about creating these tiny little mirrors. You would instead create these tiny, what would appear to be solid objects, but would be made in such a way that light could pass through them when they were aligned properly.
Yeah, I thought a really interesting article about some research that was published just this month. It was out of it was from researchers at the Australian National University. And they published a paper in Nature Communications called Spontaneous Chiral Symmetry Breaking in Metamaterials.
Mm-hmm.
And a couple of the authors were interviewed about the paper in an article for PhysOrg where they talked about the discovery. So they built this material that was capable of rotating the polarization of light. You were talking about that earlier.
Yeah.
And in order to make photonic devices like computer chips, you need to be able to control the properties of tiny amounts of light. And one of those properties is its polarization. The cool thing that these ANU researchers were able to come up with was a material that would respond to a beam of light, so they could control the behavior of the metamaterial by shining light on it or not. In other words,
huh.
so the effects, the polarization of light switching could be turned on or off with the beam of light. That means minute direct control of the effect of this metamaterial structure. And I think that's really cool. Like, one of the authors of the paper was interviewed about it, and his name was Dr. David Powell, and he said, it's another completely new tool in the toolbox for processing light. Thin slices of these materials can replace bulky collections of lenses and mirrors. This miniaturization could lead to the creation of more compact optoelectronic devices, such as a light-based version of the electronic transistor. So I think that's really cool, is making these little sort of light-controlled machines at this tiny, tiny level.
Yeah, one thing we do also have to point out is that it's generally accepted in the field of photonics. And I say that by, you know, kind of distancing myself from this, because obviously I am not an expert in these things. I have to take the information I read and try and judge its veracity as much as I can.
You know, on that note, I will say, for some reason, I find photonics one of the most difficult scientific subjects.
Well,
we research. We talk about all different kinds of subjects. We're experts in none.
Yeah.
But optical physics seems to be one of the most difficult of all the different fields.
It's quantum. It's so quantum.
Yeah.
That's so quantum. One of my favorite shows in the 90s. The
anyway, sorry, what were you saying?
Well, I was going to say that one of the things that's generally accepted is that you have a limitation here in the sense that light has set wavelengths, right?
Yeah.
You cannot change those wavelengths. That's a property of light. So different colors of light have a different wavelength, like we mentioned. Generally speaking, visible light is between 100 nanometers and 1,000 nanometers, or a micrometer in size. That's generally speaking the spectrum of light that falls into the visible range, although you probably would say more like between 400 and 700 nanometers to be fair. Now, that means that the components for photonics can only get down to about half the length of any given wavelength for the light that it's working with. Below that, it doesn't work.
Okay.
So you are limited in how small you can get with photonics. That's important to keep in mind, because electronic components have already reached to below that size. We're talking about 45 nanometers. So if we can only get these elements to be half the length or half the size of the wavelength, then we're limited at how small we can get these photonic components, right? We can't get them any smaller than that. If you're talking about a couple hundred nanometers in wavelength, then 100 nanometers is as small as you can get. And we already have microprocessors that have smaller components than that on them, which means that the photonics have to be better at processing information than the electronics are, or we have that plateau effect, right? We don't end up making progress. We either step backward or we're treading water.
Right.
So that is one thing to keep in mind, is that we may have a limit on how many components we can cram into an electronic device. Now, we may find better ways of engineering it, so that we make better use of these physical properties of light, and therefore we get better efficiency and better processing power out of it. This, again, is that idea of optimizing what you have so that it works the best way possible. And frankly, we are still working on the basics here, so it may be that, you know, 15 years down the line, we are still coming up with new ways to manipulate light and make it more efficient for our computing purposes, where we still have Moore's law going in full effect. It's just now it's applying to photonics, not electronics.
Yeah.
It's also possible that we could just make a huge leapfrog and go into like super crazy efficient computers, which really puts the pressure on those software engineers to bloat it up and keep pace.
So many features that you hate.
Yeah, exactly.
So many.
Like, let me show you how many different versions of Comic Sans we have in this word processing suite.
I just, in the future, I imagine that all native software will just have a little streaming video box up at the top corner.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, another interesting, I mean, talk about getting into subjects where we are interested, but ultimately don't really understand. I wanted to talk about spasers.
Spasers?
Spasers. Yeah.
Say that word again.
Spasers.
Okay.
Yeah, it stands for surface plasmon amplification by stimulated emission of radiation, which I assume
stimulating.
Clears it all up, doesn't it? Yeah, so technically, these are not nanoscale lasers, although that is often how they are referred to. They are think of it as an interface that exchanges a resonating electron for a photon and vice versa. And,
okay.
And so you have this component that sends resonating electrons through a substrate. Substrate is basically your foundation through which all stuff can travel. It's kind of like the basis that you build upon.
Yeah.
So in general, spacers, which have been worked on for years, were only able to use things like quantum dots, which is pretty exotic material, you could say, or precious metals that have been reduced to nanoparticle size in order to have this resonating electron be useful in any way. Not terribly practical when you want to come to like a large scale computing industry. But recent work over at Monash University's Department of Electrical and Computer Systems Engineering made a substrate from graphene, one of our favorite materials.
Mm-hmm.
It's the sheet of carbon atoms that it's one atom thick.
Oh, carbon.
And also, can you guess what the resonator is? If the substrate is graphene, what could the resonator be?
Carbon nanotubes.
You got it in one, dude. I didn't even put it in the notes. And yes, in fact, carbon nanotube and graphene pairing is what allows this stuff to work. So the cool part about this is that it could, in fact, assuming that we find really efficient ways of manufacturing graphene and carbon nanotubes, be a great advance in a basic photonic element that could make this kind of future of computing come true. It doesn't mean you have to rely so much on these other more exotic materials. But, you know, that's still years down the line before we get to a point where that's something that is readily manufacturable. But it does hold promise.
Now, we've already talked on this podcast before about another type of alternative to your standard old school electronic computer, which is quantum computers.
Yeah.
I wonder, is the photonic computer going to be something that operates alongside a quantum computer or helps us build a quantum computer?
There are.
Or what?
There are certain, there are a lot of different implementations of quantum computers, at least on paper, that would rely on photonics, that would use photons in various ways to encode information. You might remember we had our Cryptically Quantum episode, which published on June 25th, 2014. That was the one where we talked about quantum cryptography.
Right. You didn't say quantum encryption.
I almost did, and I stopped myself. Yeah, I still do that, and I know it's wrong. Keep telling me that's wrong, people, because that's the only way I'm going to learn. No, quantum cryptography, where you use the different polarizations of light in order to create a private key and share it with someone else. Photonics are going to play a big role in that. We talked about how it kind of has limitations right now, but improvements in photonics could see us develop that further so that you can actually use that on a wide network as opposed to kind of regionally locked within a certain number of kilometers. I think it was 30 kilometers before it started to fall apart.
Right.
Of course, it could come down to there are just basic laws of quantum physics that we can't get around. And then in that case, it may be a limiting factor, or it will be a limiting factor. But we don't know that yet. We also talked about quantum computers in an episode called From Qubit to Qubits, which was published on December 20th, 2013. So,
I think that was just about quantum computers, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And about how I remember one of the things we talked about is that quantum computers might be very, very useful for certain types of tasks, but in other ways might not really offer any advantages over a traditional computer.
Right.
So it's not like necessarily every computer in the future is going to be a quantum computer.
Yeah, quantum computers are really good for certain types of computer problems. Computer problems that can be divided up and solved in parallel, in particular, would be ideal for quantum computers. That's the kind of stuff that they can solve very, very rapidly. It's the stuff that classical computers tend to have a lot of trouble doing. You have to usually add more computer cores, processing cores, whether it's a multi-core processor or networking a bunch of computers together to work on a problem. It's usually the approach you have to take in order to make something like that take you know, not require an unreasonable amount of time to solve the problem. Quantum computers are very good for that. They're not so good for basic computing. I mean, they perform like a regular classic computer. And the number of qubits, those are quantum bits that your quantum computer has, determines its ability of how well does it solve these huge problems. But while you can get away with relatively few qubits compared to the processing power you'd see in a classical computer and still tackle those huge problems, it would mean it'd be a pretty slow computer for anything like, I don't know, playing the latest Call of Duty. It wouldn't be any better. In fact, it would probably be worse than your general, like, off-the-shelf PC.
Well, what a ripoff. Stop developing these things.
Look, I'm sorry that this thing that could render all existing cryptography useless isn't good enough for you to play, you know, your first-person shooter. I apologize.
Okay, so if we were able to build powerful photonic computers that sort of that could compete with good electronic computers, how would they compare in terms of energy efficiency?
That's a great question, and it's one that's really hard to answer. Until recently, the general consensus was that a photonic computer would require as much power, if not more power, than a comparable electronic machine. So it would mean that in some senses it would be inferior to an electronic computer because you would actually have to feed it more power. But there are more recent reports on developments in photonic technologies that suggest that perhaps it could be very power efficient, maybe more so than electronic computers. So it may be that the photonic computers we get down the line, assuming that this all works out, will actually require less power than a comparable electronic computer. Or maybe there is no comparable electronic computer. Maybe that the photonic computers are so efficient and so great at processing that there's nothing in our electronic world that compares to it. It's too early to say.
Okay, so I want to ask a sort of prediction question.
Okay.
But this might actually have a pretty solid answer. Imagine we make the transition to photonic computers.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Does that mean Moore's law can go on forever?
Again, hard to say. It would mostly depend upon, again, learning the best way to manipulate that light, because we are limited by physics. We cannot make those components smaller and smaller and smaller. I mean, we're limited by the wavelengths of light. Just with electricity, we're limited by how small each individual component can become before we start having electrical leakage. We are limited with how small we can make photonic components before you no longer can manipulate the light itself because the wavelengths are too long, which is hard to imagine that a wavelength of light would be too long to manipulate. But in fact, if you get down to that level, it becomes that way. You could switch. You can make an ultraviolet laser. Ultraviolet light has incredibly small wavelengths, and we do have ultraviolet lasers, excisor lasers. But to be able to translate that over to photonics would require a lot of work.
What you're saying is eventually we're going to need to have gamma ray computers.
I think eventually, once we get down to the maximum that we can exploit, I guess it's the best word for it, light, we'll either have to figure out an entirely different way to compute, or we'll just have to be satisfied that we've plateaued and we won't get any faster, which would mean that, you know, that would have huge impact on multiple industries, right? That if you said this is as good as it can get because of the way our universe works. We literally cannot make it faster because we have hit the limitations of the universe itself. Then you realize, well, we have to make do with what we have. It doesn't mean that the future won't still be amazing. It just might take longer to get here.
You know what I've just figured out? So all those old sci-fi movies that we laugh at now that picture the future with people using these gigantic building-sized computers, they were actually right.
Yeah,
what they're imagining is we reached the end of Moore's law, but Page's law continued.
Right.
And in order to keep up with the bloated software of the future, you had to make computers bigger and bigger and bigger. And there we go.
Well, so that's the thing, is that in the short term, we might see this kind of technology work its way into brand new form factors. I saw one that said, just imagine that you've turned your shirt into a cell phone. And I thought, I don't want to imagine that, but okay, I guess that would be possible using this particular modality. So assuming that future does happen, Even then, we'll get to a point where we can't go any further. We'll just be, we'll hit that hard wall of physics where we cannot, you know, you cannot break the laws of physics, as Scotty has said repeatedly, at least in my head. So yeah, it's possible that we'll see either a huge jump beyond what Moore's law would predict, assuming that photonics ends up working out and we can build practical systems based upon that.
Mm-hmm.
We could see an enormous leap ahead. We could have this time where we have the parallel development of electronic and photonic until we get to a point where we have to make the switch. Or it may just be that it doesn't work out and we'll have to figure out something else.
Well, what else is there?
Well, one approach could be to look into designing three-dimensional microprocessors.
Oh, okay.
So if you look at a microchip right now, you're essentially looking at a two-dimensional landscape.
It is three, but I see what you mean.
It's effectively two-dimensional, though. You're talking about the quantum size, like the quantum level is so in play that you can treat it as a two-dimensional system.
It's two-dimensional in the way that old-school printing is two-dimensional printing. I mean, you're still, a piece of paper is three-dimensional, but...
Sure, but a piece of paper also is enormously thick compared to a nanometer. So you're talking about something that is so thin it is hard to imagine.
Don't activate my pedantic powers, Jonathan.
Look, if you had...
It still has a depth dimension.
If you had a line of atoms across, that would be one dimensional. That's how... We're talking like super, super, super small stuff.
Okay, I agree with
you. So anyway... You essentially have a two-dimensional playing field to work with. You know, you have the surface area of the microchip, which you don't want to make larger because that would mean that you would have to start making devices larger, right? Like your phone would have to get bigger in size. Not like that hasn't happened already, but it would have to get bigger in size in order to fit more components on once we reach that fundamental, you cannot make components any smaller than this because it doesn't help the efficiency. So, if you did three-dimensional where you were able to stack these components in multiple ways so that it's not just a two-dimensional space to play in, you could really increase the amount of options you have and make Moore's law continue at least as long as you are able to still create a good architecture that works in three dimensions. And there are companies that are making three-dimensional transistors, three-dimensional gates that work in this way. No telling how much of a stopgap that would be. Like how many more years would this extend Moore's law? Don't know. But it is really worth noting that engineers have found creative ways to keep Moore's law going well beyond what people expected, just based upon redesigning the architecture of the microprocessor itself, not necessarily saying, let's get things even smaller and cram more of them on here. So, you know, I don't want this to be like doom and gloom. That's far from it. The interesting thing here is that we've got this enormous engineering challenge, and there's so many different people looking at ways to meet it.
I think they'll figure it out.
Yeah, well, they're smarter than we are, so I have faith. Anyway, that wraps up our discussion about optical computers and photonics. If you guys have any questions or perhaps you have suggestions for future episodes, we received one today, in fact, that we're looking at. You should send us a message. Let us know what you would like to hear. Tell us on Facebook or Twitter or Google Plus. Our handle at all three is FW Thinking, and we'll talk to you again really soon.
For more on this topic and the future of technology, visit forwardthinking.com. Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places.